Hello and welcome to the TCR Daily-ish podcast. First of all, let me apologise for the lack of pod yesterday. Both Cameron and Rob were unavailable. Myself and Ross had just arrived in Burgas at the finish line and things were pretty hectic down there. And frankly, we were scared to let Becky loose on the pod on her own. But we're back and today you've got just me and Becky to react to 48 hours worth of TCR goodness. So welcome back to the pod, Becky. Thanks for joining. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Tom. Missed this after 48 hours, though.
Yeah, I mean, last time we spoke, you were almost incapacitated with excitement. So I'm looking forward to seeing how you've calmed down or if you're managing to keep up that level of enthusiasm.
Marginally, I'm back on track, I'd say.
Excellent. You're able to function in society.
Yeah, one day a year.
Good. So just a quick update from the Burgas hotel where we're staying. There's no festive decorations that I can see, which is a massive disappointment compared to the last two controls I've been at. But the hotel does have a kind of Squid Game style glass floor, which was pretty terrifying to walk over. And we're actually moving on again tomorrow to a different place. So I'll be able to give you an exciting update from that as well. After this pod, we've actually only got two episodes left, which has all come around quite quickly. And the finishers party is actually on Monday night. So we're nearly there. We're getting very close.
Will that be the first finishers party you make it to, Tom?
How dare you?
I've never been. Can you tell me what it's like?
Yeah, I have been to a finishers party, actually. I'll have you know.
Oh, sorry. In,
2018. I was quite fast that year when I wasn't with Adrian.
Yeah. Or recording your podcast on the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just got on with it. Got to the finishers party. Well, it's funny you should say that, actually, because the sort of joke about the finishers party is that it's probably the lamest party you'll ever go to because you've got a load of people there that are completely sleep deprived and really just want to rest. So it's like it's quite a low energy affair normally. And, you know, there's a lot of quite haggard looking people just talking about their stories from the road and then sort of falling asleep in their drinks. So it's it's quite a funny one to go to. Speaking of finishers, do you want to go through some of the notable finishers since last time we spoke?
Yeah, so since the last podcast, for me, the most notable finisher was Amrey Kuna. She comes in as second place woman, and she will be the fourth woman in TCR history to have finished in the top 20. The others are Fiona, who's now done it twice, Juliana Böhring, and Pippa Handley. And this year is the first year that two women have finished in the top 20, which hopefully the first of many. But that's still only 10% of the top 20, Tom. So hopefully we'll have every year hereafter, it'll be a year of more firsts. And at some point we may reach 50-50. Women being the top 10, men being the second 10.
Yeah. Well, that's a great stat you've pulled out there. And that does show an upward trend, doesn't it? It's great to have someone else breaking into that top 20, representing all the women. But like you say, you know, it's just the start, isn't it? And Amrey is a really great story this year because we keep saying this every time we talk about her, but she's on the Michael Bursary scheme. So that's fantastic that's kind of working as well. Oh, bear with me one second. I need to let Ross in. This is exciting. We've just got Ross joining.
Hey, Ross.
So we were just talking about, we're talking about Amrey Kuna coming in as second place woman this year. And Becky's dug out this stat that this is the first time that two women have finished in the top 20 in a TCR, which is quite cool, isn't it? But you've you've been chatting to her on the finish line.
Yeah.
And what did she make of it?
Yeah, she was a little bit quite rightly surprised, I guess, and a little bit... I spoke to her when she had not slept after finishing, so she was still a little bit shell-shocked. And it was kind of interesting speaking to her because she didn't really want to say that she'd been really competitive, and then she was like, but I didn't really want the woman behind me to catch me, and I wanted to catch the person in front. And so she did become quite competitive, and she said that that was something that had scared her previously and she didn't really like about herself in some ways. I kind of asked her what she'd got out of the experience, and she said that she'd kind of found a lot of her personality and expanded her own boundaries and just how much she knew of herself. And she'd faced quite a lot of her fears, like her fear of dogs, mm-hmm. her fear of racing, her fear of being competitive. And she'd kind of learned quite a lot about herself through that. She was basically falling asleep when I was talking to her. It was quite hard to get something really coherent, but she was evidently really chuffed, but hadn't quite had the chance to process it all yet. And I said to her, I'll come back to her in 3 days' time and ask her the same questions and see if I get the same answers.
That's so cool to hear her talking about being competitive, because I think it's something that a lot of people shy away from saying. We always say that the sport should really be a race against yourself and you're only racing yourself, but there's no shame in racing other people. Sport is arguably the best outlet for competition, and it is a race. So I think there's nothing, it's actually a brilliant celebration to hear her say that.
Yeah, definitely. And she's only, this is her second ever race. So you can imagine for her, this is kind of like quite a bizarre experience. And I was also, I tried to kind of get out of her a little bit about how she felt about being asked questions and being interviewed. Because, I mean, once you're at the pointy end of the race, you've got someone like me or Tom interviewing you and asking you lots of very detailed questions. And I asked her how she felt about that. And she actually said she found it really helpful because it allowed her to process stuff because we were talking about this earlier, that she doesn't really think that much when she's on the bike. And I think we're going to talk about that soon. And she said that it kind of allows her to process those thoughts. So when I asked her, like, what do you think you've got out of this race or something like that? And she kind of sat quiet for quite a while and went, and then gave it an answer. And I was like, what is it like being asked those questions? She's like, yeah, it's super helpful. I actually never think about these things when I'm on the bike.
Yeah, and I thought that was fascinating. And I really want to hear what you think about this, Becky, when you've done something like the TCR. What do you think about?
I think it's probably the time for me where I just think about the big things in life. Work through, perhaps not intentionally, but you somehow come out knowing a bit more about what you want, what your priorities in life are. And I found at the end of my TCR, I was so grateful that my parents had come to the finish, not only because logistically having a lift home is really helpful, but they were the first people I wanted to see. And that stayed as a priority for me. I also knew the job I was in for the past 2 years, I hadn't been particularly fulfilled in it for a while. And I did hand in my notice the day before I left for the Highland Trail, just because I knew if I didn't do it then, I'd definitely do it when I got back.
Yeah, interesting. So it does serve a very useful role then for people to kind of get perspective and work things out on the way. Yeah. But then there's different approaches to it, and different people have different responses to all that time with nothing else to do, I guess.
Yeah, I end up putting quite a lot of pressure on myself to have those deep, meaningful thoughts and to come away from a long adventure having solved some big problem or have a different perspective on something. And actually, I end up whenever I'm out on these kind of trips, just focusing more on what's going on around me and being what people would describe as very present. And maybe that's something that you get out of after a certain amount of time. You start not noticing all the stuff around you, but I find it quite, I end up scrambling around in my brain for something to think about that's actually problematic that I can then solve. But I end up just getting a bit bored of it and thinking, oh, there's a tree and there's a thing. And I end up not really thinking about anything at all. Mm. So maybe Amarai and myself are kind of on a similar wavelength with that, because yeah, you're saying you do the more thought processing, don't you?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking, and I'm quite envious really of you and Amarai. The other thing to say, just to kind of round this off, is that there's actually a lot of practical stuff to think about and kind of calculate when you're on these races, and you think you've got all this huge amount of time that's almost infinite where you've got nothing else to do but to ride. But there's also a lot of things to work out, and especially with the kind of challenges these riders have had on this year's race, like when you're talking about the ferries and trying to work out your timings between, say, control point 4 and how long is it going to take me to get through that parkour, and then what's the knock-on effect of the ferries, and you've got so much logistics to work out all the time to do with even things like, oh, actually it's getting really hot now and the sun's starting to kind of come up, and when am I going to stop and put my sun cream on, and then when I do that, is there anything else that I can do at the same time? And you know,
it's a checklist.
Yeah, and actually that does take up quite a lot of time, so it's quite surprising.
Yeah. Becky, do you do that thing whenever you try to calculate how long it'll take you to get somewhere based on a minimum average speed?
I think I accidentally always go for my maximum average speed, and then I find I've missed the closing time. But it can be quite stressful, especially if you know you're going to run out of food or water and there's a resupply point coming up and you have no idea. In Western Europe, you kind of have an idea of what might or might not be open at certain times of the day, but heading east into the unknown, it's uncharted territory, and the opening hours are hard to predict, and the generosity of locals is also unknown. So it can be quite stressful. You think all you've got to do is ride your bike, but there's so much more to it than that.
So Becky, we've had a few more finishers. Who else has crossed the line since the last pod?
I swear I haven't just been looking at the women's dots, but my next favourite dot to finish is Megan Häkkinen, and she rounds out the women's podium behind Fiona and Amarai. She arrived today, but she said on her Instagram that she struggled to find the finish. It took her about an hour of riding around Burgas, which made me smile and reminded me of that guy who rode past the checkpoint on the first parkour, I think. And
so many of them.
Yeah. So she rode the final parkour that took riders into Burgas, and she thought the checkpoint would be at the end of it, but it wasn't. So I imagine that was a bit of a stressful moment when you think it's all over and you realize you've got to do a bit more thinking and a bit more doing.
Yeah, I've certainly done that before. Not necessarily the finish, but yeah, it's easy to do. Did you speak to her about this?
Yeah, I spoke to her, and I was speaking to the volunteers as well, who said that she had a very tearful arrival at the finish in the end, because she was just so mentally just so ruined from, you know, getting to the end of the parkour and being like, right, I expected a finish, you know, like in most of the races I do, there's a big finish line and even the race director will come out and, like, you know, take you to the finish. But in this race, it's just another problem for you to solve. And so she had not thought about, like, how to navigate to the finish line itself. And so she then on the fly had to plot her own route to get to the finish along the kind of like promenade. So obviously she was quite upset about that, and just probably just crying with relief, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it really would. It takes you off guard, doesn't it? Because at that point, psychologically, you think you've finished, and you've probably got used to the idea for quite a long time that this you don't have to solve any more problems. Yeah. And you've kind of done it and you coast into the finish. And then just when your guard is down and you think, okay, that's it, job done, suddenly you get thrown another problem that you've got to solve, but without the kind of build up, and you haven't really psyched yourself up to do it.
That was her issue, is that she said to me she built up in her head how it was going to feel to finish when she got to the end of that parkour.
Yeah.
And so she was like, I was so ready to be finished. And then I was like, no, not again, not another thing. It seems like she's had a real experience. And I asked her how she'll look back on this. And she said it will be with a lot of joy. And I guess I'm paraphrasing, but it was kind of with humility. She said she'd wanted to come a little bit higher up in the placings, but that she'd made some mistakes that she thought were just basic mistakes. And she said to herself, you know, Megan, what are you doing? You know, like, you should really have thought about this. And she does a lot of self-talk on the bike. Apparently she talks to her bike as well. She says, come on, bike, I know that you've been going really long and your chain's squeaky. I'll oil you when you get to the top of this climb. You're doing real good. Like, very Canadian.
She did a great bit of self-talk when I saw her just coming off the ferry, and she was dealing with a puncture. She was putting her tire back on, and she was putting the tire back on, and she went, come on, Megan, dominate the tire.
What's it like for you, Becky, whenever you kind of get into a situation you need to sort of problem solve a little bit? Do you do like that kind of self-talk at all?
Oh yeah, definitely. I remember reading one of Lee Craigie's posts about the Highland Trail, and she said she talks to herself like she's a child, in a very like, come on now, what do we need? I think we just need some food. Should we try and get this food down? Should we try some water? Because you are so fragile in those moments, having someone like hold your hand, and you just need to be looked after, but you're the only one who's there. So I find treating myself as if all I have are very basic needs, which is kind of what it is when you're racing, that's worked really well. And I do talk to myself as well. And I've been caught out. I don't think James Robertson's caught me out, but a couple of other riders and photographers have. And you just, there's no way I'm the only one who talks to myself when I'm riding. So you don't even apologize.
Yeah. There's got to be a James Robertson jar here that we put a penny into every time James gets a mention.
I think he's got a mention on every single pod probably so far, isn't he? The other interesting thing that Megan was talking about, and we wanted to just use it as a bit of a talking point, is she slept in this kid's playground in like a little tiny like Wendy house to shelter from a storm, which we thought was quite a funny image. And she said that she literally only just about fitted in it, and it probably wasn't that comfortable. So, I mean, that's a good question for you, Becky. Have you got like a memorable sleeping spot from your racing?
Oh man, I don't think I do.
Is that because you're in a hotel every night?
Yeah. And no dodgy five stars for me, Tom. They've all been excellent. Yeah. I've had a few dodgy ones when I've been touring, when I've been in like a empty bus stop or gas station, and there's like used wet wipes around, and you're like, oh, why are they here? But you fall asleep easy enough. But I can't think of anything when I've been racing. Maybe you just block them out of your memory.
Becky, did you not stay in that Serbian wedding hotel on the last TCR?
No, I went, I don't know, 50K up the road and got a really, I say a really good hotel. It was just exactly what you needed. And they served breakfast at 6 a.m. So it was banging.
Oh, it's the dream.
Yeah.
Good choice.
But I do remember a couple of stories coming out of that wedding hotel. And I was glad I'd made the decision to carry on down the road a bit, even if it meant riding through the storm.
Yeah, you made a good choice there. You got a couple of interesting stories today from riders about sleeping spots, because we've been asking that specifically to try and pull out some interesting stories.
Yeah, Leandro Sanz, the Swiss man, he was telling me that when he was in Serbia, he was riding through the night and he suddenly started hearing tons of gunshots. And he was like, no, please, like, you know, don't shoot. I'm a cyclist. But, you know, they seemed to not hear him. or something, and they kept getting closer and closer, and he, you know, he was like, he thought he was in a hunting party or something like that. And he booked a hotel for that night, but he decided he was just going to try and find shelter as quick as he could. So he just dived down to the nearest town, and found this petrol station and asked the guy there, can I find somewhere to sleep? And the guy was like, well, yes, if you don't make any noise, you can sleep on the couch in the back room. Otherwise, my boss will kill me if he finds out. The kindness of strangers, nice bit of a story there. I also had a story from Tim DeVita, who also in Serbia, slept in a field and sort of like bedded down. And then at some point in the night heard like snorting going on. And he was like, what is that? And sort of like shone a torch, and he could just see these like, he was like, I could just see these big wild pigs. And I don't know if they were like boar or something, but wild pigs. And he was like, I got up and I shot right out of there. It was so funny.
So Serbia really coming through as the premier destination for weird sleeping experiences. All right, then let's move on to another finisher. Becky, a particular bike has taken your interest here.
Yes. Earlier today, the Italian rider Daniele Fonelli finished in 12 days, 18 hours and 26 minutes of riding. And he is the first fixie finisher. We've had a little dive and we found that his gearings are 47 by 17 or 22. And I hope I'm saying this right, because I don't really speak fixed, but it's a fixed hub. So it's not a flip-flop hub. I had to do some Googling earlier. So he's got a 17 tooth cog or a 22 tooth cog on the back and a 47 up front. But it's a custom steel bike. And one of the things that he's done is he's put disc brakes on the front, but he couldn't have disc brakes on the back because he can flip the rear wheel. So he's had to put a V-brake on the rear. And it was just I thought it was a really cool custom TCR bike. And any fixie's cool. This stuff's hard enough anyway. Only allowing yourself one or two gears is mad. And he's done it fully fixed as well. So it doesn't have the ability to freewheel, which is mad. But one of the other things I picked up from his bike were his bike packs. And I urge people to go and find it. It's on the bikepacking.com Rigs of Transcontinental piece. And he has a half frame pack, a saddle pack, a handlebar bag, some food pouches on his bars, a top tube bag. And then he actually, just looking at it now, he's got this really unique pack at the top of his rear triangle. Can you see that? Almost behind the brakes.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, but you've got there before me. But yeah.
I asked him about it, and he was like, I said, what's in there? And it's actually just a couple of spare tubes. But he was like, I just wanted to utilize the space as much as possible, because usually that bag would go inside the frame and would maybe go just like at the bottom of the seat post, but inside the frame. But he was like, I had the frame bag and I wanted to fit it somewhere else. And also he's getting an aerodynamic advantage to a degree, because he's filling in a gap.
Yep.
So then just that's true. That's how you do it. Yeah.
But what struck me was the colour of the frame packs. They're fluorescent yellow. And I thought this was brilliant, because when you talk about the visibility of a bike rider, we're guilty of only thinking about the other road user's view directly from behind or directly ahead, which is fine when you're on a straight road. But at junctions or, I don't know, perhaps tight corners, having so much visibility from the side, I mean, you can look at the photo and see that frame pack. It's like having a high-vis jacket wrapped around your bike. It's so visible in a way that so few bikes are. And I just thought it was a really nice safety mechanism. I mean, I can't stand the colour, and 4,000 kilometres of looking at that would make me sick, but it's each to their own.
Well, the beauty of that is you don't have to look at it really, do you? There's not much of that you could see from actually being on the bike.
True.
And there's another rider that's taken a similar approach, which is Matthew Lifchitz, who has got a similar thing, but all in bright orange. And it's a really one of the coolest looking rigs on the TCR. And he's a real veteran. He's done it a lot of times. But crucially, it looks really cool. And I think if you can get something that looks really cool and is high vis, then that's a winner, isn't it?
A high vis jacket is one of the safety requirements, isn't it? Some kind of high vis body, gilet or straps. But this is a whole new level.
Can I just mention Josh Reed?
Yeah.
Yeah, so another guy to finish today was Josh Reed, who has actually, after Young Nai Lee, scratching, who was the youngest rider at 22 years old, Josh became the youngest rider to still be riding the TCR this year at 24. And people might know Josh through his drone, and A Long Way Home or something like that, when he flew to the giant store in China and then rode back home. The factory, that's it. He rode back from a factory in China. And it's got hundreds of thousands of views online. But so Josh finished today in the afternoon. I hung out with him for a little while, and he told me this fantastic story where he loves watermelons. And he actually showed up, he went away from the finish line and came back with like half a watermelon that was like probably weighed about the same as his bike. And he was telling me the story that when he was in Croatia, he went up to a watermelon stand to go and buy a watermelon and just eat it whole, basically. He just has a spoon and he just digs it out. And then as he was like eating it, the guy said, "Oh, I have to go and like check my family for some reason." And he asked Josh if he could look after the stall for him. So whilst racing the TCR, Josh just accidentally became a watermelon vendor at the same time. He got a job. I mean, which is good because he just left his job. He just goes and asks that guy for a job back when he's next going through Croatia. So, but yeah, Josh has done phenomenally well. And he went over the moor like in fourth or fifth position, much to Andrew Phillips' disdain, because he actually clipped Andrew as he was going up. And I think Andrew gave him a good earful when he went past. But yeah, Josh has been good fun to watch, and it's good on him finishing as the youngest rider. But he's massive talent. Like, he's new to racing, really. He raced All Points North. Mm-hmm. That was his first race, actually.
Yeah, he did well in that, learned quite a lot of stuff.
Seems
from
so.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. So good on him. And hopefully we'll see him at another race. He says he's a bit done now with racing. He's like, "I want to go on tour or something again. It's much more fun. Mm-hmm. I want to eat watermelons without being stressed."
Okay.
And sell watermelons.
Yeah.
Without ending up in employment. Okay, well, the pairs race is really hotting up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you seen this, Becky? What's going on here? We've had a first pairs finish happen, which was the early hours of this morning, I think.
Yeah, like 3 a.m. or 1 to 3 a.m. I think.
Which was Stefan and Teo, who I'm sure we've mentioned those guys a fair bit on the pod. And then, have you seen this race for second?
Yeah, for second pair. They look to be right next to each other. Perhaps the gates are a couple of kilometres behind, but they're just hitting that final parkour, right?
Yeah, it's hard to work out. Where are they up to now? Did they converge?
Christopher and Jonathan are about to go onto the parkour. Oh, man, I wish I was down there to see this. This would be so good. And I wonder...
Would you guys always...
Well, they did converge, didn't they?
This is a good exercise in seeing how two riders can be riding with each other, but their dots can be telling a slightly different story, because you would assume that the first pair on the map, or the first rider on the map, is where that pair is, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at these four dots, they look like they are, maybe a couple of kilometers apart, but they're not. They will be right next to each other.
Yeah, I think they actually would have seen each other when they hit that junction at Vreshevo, which is just like about maybe 10 kilometers before, because their dots pinged for the gates at 21:52 and for the other pair at 21:51 or something like that. And so they must have literally on the road at the exact same time. I mean, it is a bit... This is the thing about the ferries that does change the race a bit, because the gates had quite a good advantage. And I am amazed at Christopher and Jonathan, because from what I can see on the map, it doesn't look like they've really stopped since the Transalpina.
Mm.
And I thought that they would have cracked a bit, but it seems that they've just...
What's really fascinating about this is that they came over on different ferries, as in from different places. And this seems to be the point where they've converged. So they've Christopher and Jonathan coming in from the west. So I think they probably went over at Ternu, and then the gates would have gone over at Zimnitsia from the east. Yeah. And then they've both made their way down and come together about 50K away from the start of the finish parkour, which is just great stuff, isn't it?
What was quite cruel when we went over the Zimnitsia ferry ourselves, actually, in the car, and although it says it's a 15-minute crossing, it took us nigh on 2 hours to get from one side to the other. And all the riders were also held up in that. It is a bit of carnage, to be honest. It's not a seamless system. And so it's an extremely painfully slow process. But and then all the riders get held up in a little pen at the end, and then they show their passports and then they let go. So I think maybe the gates lost a little bit time there.
Yeah, well, and we went over on the other ferry and it was pretty quick.
Well, there we go, a real life example. Yeah.
So
you were happening before us.
Yeah, yes, yeah, true. The other interesting kind of race that's been going on within the race is our Lanterne Rouge at the back of the GC pack, who are now trying to reach CP4 in time for the cutoff, which is 4 a.m. on the 8th of August. So that's the morning of the finishers party. Yeah. So they've got, is that two days to get there?
Yeah. From now? They've got like maybe... 30 hours or something like
that. Yeah.
Sorry, is it not 4 a.m. on the Monday morning and then the finishers party's 10 p.m. on Tuesday evening?
No.
Oh.
The finishers party is on the Monday night.
Ah, right. Sorry, I've seen the... Got it. Oh, so the actual finish is a day later.
Yeah, the finish actually closes at 10 p.m. on... which has kind of always been the case. I asked Anna and David about this, and they said it's just because people have been hanging around by that point for quite a while.
Yeah.
And so most people are at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does feel a little bit funny. Just
Didn't Fiona say that she's not going to be able to stay to the finishers party because she has to get back to work?
Yeah, she leaves tomorrow. So yeah, that's busy being a surgeon.
Yeah, saving lives.
Oh.
Yes. Yeah, so I could be wrong. I'm just using what's on Follow My Challenge, and they may be a little off. But the numbers I have are: there's 107 riders still riding. 39 have finished. We prepped these numbers about 2 hours ago, so they're already out of date. And then 94 DNFs so far. But we'll see more finishes, obviously, and more DNFs by the time the race is over. And then we'll also see the split in the finishes between the GC finishers and the ones with an unclassified finish or an out-of-classification finish.
Yeah, and we won't know exactly about that for a few days after the finish, I imagine. Do you feel like that's quite a lot of scratches so far?
No. given where everyone is, where most people have passed on the map, I think they are past that point of no return, if you will. And they're at the yeah. point where they'll just carry on, regardless if they make the finisher's party or the finish cutoff, they'll just carry on riding. The temptations to scratch, I think, probably came a bit earlier. Yeah, I think they'll carry on. If you look at the map and you see all the faded out dots of where people have scratched, it's a bit haunting, really, seeing all these greyed out dots.
Ghosts.
Yeah, it's the ghost of dots past. They seem to be clustered before and a little bit after the second checkpoint, which is exactly as Rob predicted. So I think... the rate at which people scratch has and will continue to slow down because people are probably yeah. just going to get to the finish now.
Yeah. And you've taken a little bit of a look at one of the TCR legends who's known for some interesting route choices, and he's living up to his reputation, isn't he?
Yeah, so I just couldn't believe where Mikko Mäkipää was, because he, yet again, I think for the third time in the race, his dot had gone a completely different way to everyone else's. And it almost looked, he was just about to cross from Serbia into Romania. No, he already had, sorry. But he was so far east, he looked like he was just joining up with all the dots heading south off the parkour. I almost thought he was about to scratch or just miss out the final parkour, but... No, he's got just come off the fourth parkour, I believe. But if you do have a look at his dot, what's interesting is to see the total distance he's done so far compared to the dots around him. And there's one rider near him who's probably taken as imaginative a route, because he's also, Mikko's total distance so far is 4,128 kilometers, which isn't far off what some people have by the time they get to Burgas.
Yeah.
and then Frank Proud near him is just under 4,100, but a lot of the other riders are more like 3,800, 3,900. So Kirsten Cluley, who's near him, is actually 3,750, which, using my quick maths, is about 400 kilometers shorter. And Mikko's added, I think I worked out, about an extra 100k, 160 to 240k on average compared to everyone else. And that's maybe 20-25k a day, which is enough. It's an extra hour's riding. I as surprised as I was to see a dot so far east, I wasn't surprised to see the initials were MM, because I think Mikko's notorious for this now.
Yeah, he's got a kind of slightly different philosophy to racing than a lot of other people, and he does like to try and give himself an extra challenge. And he's just got such a crazy knowledge of all of Europe now that I think he probably just gets a bit bored more than anything else with going yeah. back to the same places.
I was going to say, do you reckon he walks into bars in Eastern Europe and they just go, the usual? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Ice cream and an espresso, please.
I think we talked about this before, but did you see that he's returned to a bus stop that he's stayed in on a previous TCR?
Fond memories.
Yeah, and slept in the same one. When I looked him up to see where he was at, I discovered there was another Mikko on the race who's obviously from Finland.
So I know, I felt so bad when I saw that as well.
And
they're both Finnish, right?
Yes, I don't know. I don't know how old Mikko Keinu is, but maybe he's like the apprentice and the original
Mikko's protege.
Hand down the
gauntlet.
Finally, on this Lantern Rouge topic, I had an update from Eric Veneman, who we've been following very closely recently, and he's been up against these time cutoffs for CP2 and CP3, and for both of them he's just scraped in at the last minute and had to give absolutely everything that he's got to make it. And I think it sounds like he's reached the end of his ability to do that, really, and he's reached the end of his kind of resources. So he sent a message saying, "Last night's hiker bike, the heat and overall fatigue exhausted me beyond a point I'm willing to push myself on busy roads. I'm so proud of the way I've ridden and the joy and energy I felt for the last 2 weeks. It's time to rest now. I'm quite emotional. Thank you for the immense support coming through the pod. Just can't cycle any faster or rest less," which is a reference to Rob's coaching advice there, and which he was trying to follow, but he's found the limits of Rob's insight there, unfortunately. But yeah, so Eric's actually got a flight on Wednesday, so he's got a bit of a time deadline, and obviously he's got a new baby to look after and be a dad for. And so he's decided to catch a train to Burgas to hang out with some of the friends that he's made out on the road before he returns home to just kind of really soak up the full extent of the experience.
Yeah, Eric, if you are listening,
which I'm sure you are,
you've done a fantastic job, mate. Well
yeah,
done.
Yeah, we're all super proud of you.
Seconded.
And shout out to the Merman mascot, who I know is an equal part of your team, if not an official pairs partner. Yeah, well, we won't tell Anna about that. He's really pulled you through. So yeah, big shout out to you as well.
So who is our current Lantern Rouge then?
Well, it's a good point. Can we look that up live?
Sergey?
I was just going to say Sergey.
Shalubin, who is
the
writer.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So there are two of them. And Sergey squeaked in. Oh, his timestamp is 0050 EST.
Yikes.
Which means he made it in the last minute.
Wow.
That is scraping it fine, isn't it?
God, look how many riders there are. There's the 1, 2, 3, the 5 last riders who made it in to the third checkpoint within the time cut all came in with 20 minutes to closing. They must have been sprinting.
Four of them in the last 10.
Wow.
That must have been a race and a half.
That would have been a great control point to be at, wouldn't it?
Sorry, Christoph Strasser, that your win means nothing. Yeah. This is where the race is really
at. Yeah.
Gosh, that is exciting. And it looks like on the road, actually, behind Sergey, is it Torsten Frank looks to be our Lantern Rouge on the road. Yeah. But they're pretty close. They look a couple of kilometres apart. And then there's Nadine, who's between them, and she also made the cutoff for the third parkour. So I think it's Torsten Frank is our Lantern Rouge.
Nice one, well done, Torsten. Keep it up, mate. Good, good guy, and he's got a lot of experience. In TCR,
just got to ride fast and rest less.
Yeah, yeah, as we all know. We can do this live, can't we? Have there been any more scratches?
Andrea de Gutolo. He was last seen 8 hours ago and he's a DNF. Bela Kuzla. Last seen 11 hours ago and they're a DNF.
Berk Okye. Maybe. He reached CP3 last night but is now scratched.
It's good looking at the map. There's very few black dots after the third checkpoint. Hey, and I guess once everyone crosses that border into Romania and they go to the fourth control point and they do the fourth parkour and then they start heading south again to Bulgaria, it's going to be pretty hard to justify scratching when you're so close. And it's once you get to the fourth control point, it's pretty much a straight run into Burgas. So it's interesting to see. There's currently no scratches between the fourth control point and the finish.
So there's also Henry Ney and Peter Van Endert. And a real shame, I'm just looking at this, it looks like Lionel Bob scratched, who I think he was our actual Lantern Rouge. And
he was continuing after his partner, Gary Cunnington, scratched because of COVID.
Right.
Fair play to Lionel for keeping it going for so long. I think, yeah, he definitely scratched just recently. Heard Anna speaking about him on the phone today. So yeah.
Yeah. Shame. That's a real shame. Unlucky. Well done, Lionel.
Yeah. Good on him for pushing.
Definitely.
On. Yeah. Hopefully, we'll see him back. So yeah, we've had a few reports coming through from Robbie, who's like our social media source. Cap 110 Rodrigo Lombard showed that it wasn't just Ulrich thwarted by the low levels in the Danube, as last night the ferry Zimnisia was also cancelled, the last one of the day, because of low water levels. Wow. So he had to wait for an extra 12 hours before getting the next one in the morning. Wow. So another ferry has been affected.
Even bike races are certainly affected by the issues of the climate crisis, you know. It really has a proper impact. Yeah. That 41 degrees C that we're seeing there.
And I was just thinking about those wildfires that we saw as well and around Control Point 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what's this that you've pulled out here from Instagram?
This guy's handle is Barry on a Bike. He's Barry Duploc, Cap 90. He scratched about a week ago, but yesterday he put a post up on his Instagram. And I'll read it. It says, I entered into the Transcontinental looking for the challenge of a lifetime, and I definitely found it. So much so, it nearly broke me. I'm still massively disappointed I couldn't carry on for longer, but that's now mixed with feelings of being grateful that I had a chance to be part of an incredible event and do an incredible thing. The nature of being challenged is that sometimes you don't achieve what you wanted. Otherwise, would it really be a challenge? Injury or bad luck can happen at any time and cruelly end your race. My mindset is slowly changing from I only completed 1,400 kilometers of a 4,000 race to I single-handedly cycled 1,400 kilometers across Europe in 5 days. Time to relax, heal, readjust, rethink, and refocus. I think an excellent blueprint for anyone who is scratching and will inevitably face those feelings of disappointment and maybe a bit of shame, which is totally unjust. I think his words might resonate with people, and it probably come at a time when a lot of people who have DNF'd might need to hear them most. It might be a good time to talk about what you can do post-race, because for anyone who scratched because of an injury, or even the people who finish, often come out with niggles in those moments where you are disappointed or confused and you need some headspace. Typically going for a bike ride is your coping mechanism, but in the absence of that, you need to find something else to do, because you'll have all these pent-up emotions regardless of where you finished, and finding a way to let those emotions out is a really healthy thing to do. I don't really have the answer on that, but I suppose it's probably just very individual.
The other thing is that when you're doing embarking on doing is like a bigger project than doing just the actual race itself, so there'll be months and months, if not probably a year, of preparation and planning, and it can be quite all consuming. So once that's gone, then it leaves quite a big void. So one obvious thing to do is to make sure that you've got something lined up afterwards to kind of throw yourself into and look for, and that's going to take up quite a lot of your time, and you basically want a project to get into and really care about. And then when you're ready, if you're still into it, then sign up to another race.
The next post that I found on Instagram, it really made me smile. Bruno Ferraro, he put on his Instagram that after the ferry boat crossing, he and two other riders started at a good pace, and their average speed was about 30 kilometers an hour. But he was around 100 kilometers to the finish when his shifter's cable snapped. So he's able to fix this with zip ties to get a decent gear going, and he kept on moving. But after a few more kilometers, his rear tire deflated, and he'd had to patch it after a puncture on the fourth parkour. He rode about 80 more kilometers with five or six more flats until he ran out of patches and couldn't repair it anymore. So he managed to hitch a lift to Burgas, get the bike fixed, and heart-wrenchingly had to ride from the finish in Burgas out to where he left the route and finish his route in order to be in with a GC finish. And the TCR rules state that once your bike is fixed, you have to ride back to the point on the route that you left.
That's true.
Which, luckily for Bruno, he may not have thought this at the time, sounds like it was only about an extra 70 kilometers, so 70 kilometers back to the point where he left, and then he finished the route, which isn't too much at all. I think some riders have had it worse than that.
He lost 10 places, yeah. I think. He ended up rolling in 22nd.
Yeah.
But I mean, that doesn't say anything about how much of a blooming struggle he went through to turn that 180k round trip that he ended up having to do. So, wow. Sounded like he was reconsidering his decision like every 5 minutes, and he even had thought about scratching when he reached the finish line the first time. He said to Rory Kemper, he was like, I think I'm just going to scratch. I can. Mm. And Rory was like, tears. Everybody was like, you got to get back out there, man. Yeah. You're so close. Yes. You're literally here.
Yeah.
Just go back out that way and then come back again. And you'll be done.
Yeah. That's an amazing effort to do that.
Oh, yeah. Chapeau.
Definitely chapeau. I was just going to say chapeau. Yeah.
Wow, we're on the same wavelength.
Two P's.
All right. Well, we've just about got time for one listener question. Do you want to take us through it, Becky?
Yeah. So this question comes from, I guess this guy's the only bear that every rider is guaranteed to see on this year's TCR. Thank you.
Oh,
thank you so much. This comes from Rory Kemper. So it's technically not a listener question. It's more of a former race coordinator question. But his question he sent in too, and he says, what impact have the ferries had on the overall race in your view? And do you think it's a positive thing? I would say it's definitely a positive thing. It's added so much drama, and I think it's become quite a leveler for riders. There's very little they can do when the tides of change come in, and they're faced with cancelled ferries. And even the most prepared rider has suffered at their fate. So I've definitely thought they're a good thing, especially having them so late in the race.
Yeah, I mean, there's two obvious sides to this, aren't there? There's, on the one hand, it is quite a fun element, but then it's a little bit unfair in a way to the guys that turn up and they've actually got like maybe up to a 12-hour lead, which you would think normally means you're a much stronger rider or a much stronger pair, and then that can just get by the ferry times.
I think outside of a race context as well, like getting a ferry, probably do on a trip like this, it's kind of an adventure, isn't it? You get a ferry across the river Danube. It's kind of like, that's part of it. It's part of going on this adventure and exploring and discovering new things and having random encounters with Bulgarian ferry ticket ladies who are shouting at you for no particular reason is part of that experience. You know, it's a real life situation that you have to problem solve to deal with, and that is something that is just part and parcel.
It also forces an interaction with the locals as well, which is always a good thing.
Yeah. And I'll say in Rory's defense, today at the finish line, he was listening to the pod. Right. So he is a listener.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, he is a listener. Yeah.
He did have a second question that was, what do people want at the finish? And that's you, Rory, handing them a beer, obviously, because he is one of the staff at the finish, which is supported by Apadura.
I think people really want a £500 Apadura voucher. That's what I've heard. Everyone's been asking for that.
Yeah, also they want a beer. And Rory said he'll personally buy a beer for every rider that finishes. So
tradition of buying a beer is gone. It's just Rory now.
Rory's taking over on that one. So you can hold him to that. Great. Well, that is all we've got time for. We've had another absolute bumper episode here. I think it's when Ross gets involved, we just really spend twice as much time. But having said that, thanks so much, Ross, for coming on again. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. Great fun.
Thanks, Becky, for coming back as well. Always so fun to have you on.
Thanks, guys. This has been a really good one.
And don't forget, you can send in any questions. I mean, we haven't got many episodes left, but if you've still got any questions, thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating and review, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. Not many left now. This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.